It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, who would have thought that science would be controversial, especially when it has to do with food? Well, it has become controversial. And just science in general has gotten a lot of attention lately, and not too long ago there was a march for science, some would say concern with science. We've got somebody to talk to today about science, but also especially as it's relating to food, and no doubt it'll touch on a little bit of controversy. Our guest today, I think, would consider himself a scientist, Dr. Carl Harl von Mogel. Carl, welcome to Farm to Table Talk. Would it be fair to call you a scientist?
Certainly, yeah. So, yeah, I'm happy to be here. And I got my PhD in plant breeding and plant genetics a few years ago at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I got a minor in life science communication because I've got a dual passion for both doing science, learning about it, and helping others to understand it.
Well, you're doing that then right now. I think I want to back up a little bit on the science, because when you start talking about having other people understand it, you were involved in this march on science. There have been a lot of marches in this year, but you were involved in a march on science. And I saw that you actually had an event in San Francisco where people could come up and talk to you and ask questions. How did that go?
Yeah, so let me back up just a moment. I co-founded an organization called Biology Fortified. We started out as a blog just at biofortified.org, and we launched on Halloween in 2008 with a post saying, "What scares you about GMOs?" with pictures of Frankenstein and stuff like that. And over the years, we've been trying different approaches to science communication, and it's an independent organization. We're not funded by industries one way or another, except, I guess, the t-shirt industry. Every now and then we do a t-shirt drive. And this year, there was a lot of attention on science and political influence on science in many different fields. And there was another group that started up called the March for Science, and we formally partnered with them this year to help out with the march. And we had my co-founder Anastasia. She gave a talk in Washington D.C. and a demo talking about genetically engineered crops. We had somebody tabling in Chicago, and then I also participated in the march in San Francisco, and then got up on a little platform and gave a little science demo with some genetically engineered potatoes, showing how the regular potatoes brown from the enzyme polyphenol oxidase, or PPO, and then how you can show how that enzyme works using lemon juice and restricting oxygen, or in the case of this non-browning potato, showing that it doesn't brown when it doesn't have the enzyme. So we had a lot of fun and also were able to reach a lot of people who are concerned, as we are, with how science is seen and its influence on policy.
So the people that came to talk to you, were they on both sides of the issue? Did you have people that were suspicious and critical, as well as people that are fans?
Yeah, so I think we had a good mixture. It's interesting to see how people react during random, times when you talk about this topic, you go to events specifically about it, or you go to something like the March for Science, where everybody was in general on board with the idea of, let's learn about what the science is and then make policy based on that. And I think because of the kind of people that were attracted to this march and the frame of mind that they were in, the reception was a lot more positive than we had seen in other places. But certainly there were some people who were, the topic of biotechnology and food, food's very personal, and biotech is fairly new, and the public's not very aware of the topic, and so for some people it can be kind of a scary thing. But I think it was still pretty good. People were open-minded, and I got some good conversations.
You know, every time I do a story that touches on GMO, I ended up getting responses on Facebook and others that are accusing us of being sponsored by Monsanto or whoever they're concerned about.
And yeah, you said, or the competing industries.
Right. Well, you were, right off the bat, you explained forming this organization. I mean, was it spontaneous, or, I mean, you really weren't getting funding from these large companies? Because if you didn't, it seems like that would be something that would have come up, that they had an interest in having people better understand biotech. But
yeah.
But did you draw a line from the outset that you weren't going to take money from them?
Yeah, that's what we decided from the beginning. And the way this all started was, I was doing I wrote for the school paper at my alma mater, UC Davis, where I got my bachelor's in genetics. I tried out a science radio show and podcast, and having much the same experiences that you are with building an audience. And when I went to grad school in Madison, I started to shift my focus in blogging to talking about plant genetics as I was studying it more. And I ran into other like-minded scientists online in discussions, and that's how I ran into Anastasia Bodnar. She was at Iowa State at the time as a grad student. And then my former professor of mine at Davis, Pam Ronald, started blogging in conjunction with her book, Tomorrow's Table. She was also speaking at the March for Science. She was one of our founders, as I'm saying. And David Tribe in Australia and at the University of Melbourne, he was also blogging about this. And I sent a fateful email to everybody saying, hey, we're all kind of blogging about this and talking about this, and we have, I think, similar ideas. Why don't we make a blog where we all put our posts together and have it as a group rather than each by ourselves? And then that's how it started.
So you're talking about especially genetic engineering. Now, do you refer to it as GMOs or genetic engineering or biotechnology? I mean, what's a phrase you use most often?
Yes. Well, the GMO can mean different things to different people. You know, some thought that it would be a softer term than using genetic engineering or the, but it's still, people, you know, they treat it, even though it's three letters, they treat it like a four-letter word. It can be scary for some, and it's certainly used in marketing against genetically engineered foods. So there are a lot of scientists who don't like to use that term because it carries very different meanings and connotations. But on the other hand, it's one of the terms that's used the most often. So what I usually do is, so people know that I'm talking about the same topic, I'll use the term GMO, and then I then switch to saying genetic engineering, because I think that is more accurate to what's going on. And then if I really want to drill down into very specific methods, you know, some genetically engineered crops would be considered transgenic, and others maybe cisgenic would be slightly different, you know, genes from the same species, but still inserted in like you would with other genetically engineered crops. And I feel that approach helps attract people to the topic, but who are aware of the other terms being used, like GMO, but then it gives me a chance to talk about things that are a bit more scientifically accurate. I've been interested to find out what people believe GMO really means in a more scientific fashion, like do some sort of a survey, to like one of those personality tests, to see what is your personal definition of a GMO, because it can mean very different things to different people.
Well, what's an example? What are the kinds of things you learned from that?
So like from like such a survey, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, for instance, sometimes when I give talks about genetically engineered crops, actually, usually I will start out with an explanation of just plant genetics in general and why plant breeders and genetic engineers want to and need to change the genetics of the food crops that we eat. And that's because diseases are always changing, pests and weeds are always changing, and even consumers' desires are always changing. And if we don't work on breeding, then eventually we're going to end up with a crop that won't grow and nobody will want to eat. So then I talk about the different techniques that are used, and there is crossbreeding or traditional breeding, as it's often called, which is what most people are familiar with. But there are many other techniques in between what you might consider a GMO or not. There are things like polyploidy, where you double the number of chromosomes, for instance. This is how seedless watermelons are made. They have three copies of every chromosome, which is why they don't produce seeds. The cells don't divide properly, and the seeds don't develop. So sometimes, if you ask people, you know, would manipulating the number of chromosomes make something a GMO? They'll go, yeah, that kind of sounds like a GMO to me. Or you can do chemical mutagenesis. You treat a seed with a mutagen to try to create random mutations in the DNA, and then you grow that plant and see, does this have some new trait that could be interesting? I ask people sometimes which of these traits are allowed in organic farming, and usually people say mutagenesis is not allowed, but it turns out it is. For some people, it seems like a very different kind of thing. You know, soaking it in a mutagen sounds scary, but it really just causes some random changes to DNA. Most of them don't do anything. A few make the plant worse, but every now and then you get some that are better. So I find that when people have we don't have much familiarity with the science of this, the opinions can be in many different places, and what people would call it weird or call a GMO can vary from one person to another.
Well, of those different approaches, I would imagine that when you start explaining to people that they can accept that this technology may be helpful, that maybe there can be some reasons to do this. Are there, do you think there are enough examples to show that using this technology is making food taste better or being more nutritious or be more safe or be more affordable? And I'm guessing that the last one is the easiest to prove, but in that whole spectrum, isn't that what most consumers really care about? Is
the genetically engineered crops that are on the market are mostly crops that have traits that farmers are interested in that help with weed control or insect pest control. And then there are a few cases of disease control with papayas and squash. And then also there's drought tolerance in maize as well. But there are a few that are coming out that are, I think, a little bit more interesting for consumers. I mentioned the non-browning potato. That could actually be a really big convenience factor for some people, where you can shred your potatoes long before you cook them, and or chop them up, and they're not going to turn all pink and brown on you and get gross. And then there's also a non-browning apple. Now these are all fairly simple traits, and things like flavor are very complex. And the state of the technology is usually you have a few genes that you engineer into a plant. And so it's very difficult to get those kinds of more complex things like flavor to work. And it's still right now, breeding is the best approach for some of those traits because you have a lot of variation in those traits, and you can breed them together and select out the best ones. So you're selecting many, many different genes at once.
Let's talk about, though, it's been, 25, 30 years since we started having progress with genetic engineering. And in all that time, they kept talking about doing nutrition and so forth, but weed control and insect control has dominated. You touched on that. You said it's because that's what the farmers wanted. So I assume that's where the incentive was for these companies to work on that area, because it was easy for them to create a demand, and there was a demand.
Yeah, there's certainly a bigger rate of return if you've got many more acres, and then you have a problem affecting those acres, then there's, you know, the business side of it, and I'm not a business person, but on the business side of it, you can get people to invest in something that can get a return on that investment easier with something like that. But for things that are, you know, vegetable crops, specialty crops, horticultural crops, much smaller acreage, and less possibility of getting that back. Now, if you couple in the some of the opposition to genetically engineered crops, some of the campaigns that have been mounted against companies that produce them or farmers that grow them, and it becomes harder for investors to want to actually do that. I've talked to people in academia and industry who are sitting on traits that work, that have been published and well characterized that could be useful, but they would then have to get it through the regulations and get it into the hands of farmers, and that's a much, much more difficult thing. I often hear the argument, well, where are all these interesting GMOs that you say could be useful? And the thing is, they exist. They're just not getting to the farmers and not getting to the people right now. There is there's actually a documentary that's coming out this June called Food Evolution, narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And conflict of interest alert, I appear in the film briefly, but the film talks a lot about the papayas in Hawaii and what happened with those, and then also goes to Uganda and talks about wilt-resistant bananas. And the bananas are there, they work, they exist, and they brought farmers there to look at them, and they're like, can we have these bananas because all of my bananas are dying from wilt? And the answer is no, because they don't have the biosafety law in place, or didn't at the time, and so it's being held up. And so a lot of these things are real, and they exist, and I try to tell this to people, and there's just... we need a stronger bridge between the science and the people who could ultimately use and benefit from these.
Well, let's talk about this journey that you're on, though. When you're explaining to people the promise, in many cases, of good genetic engineering. And I would guess that maybe a majority could hear your story and say, okay, I buy that. It could be beneficial, but this is where you start running into trouble, I suppose, is that, well, what do we have to show for it to date? And I think you're mentioning there are some traits on the horizon, but this horizon just kind of keeps moving. But one of the concerns I hear the most about, Carl, is that since there has been so much attention to the weed control and using it for weed control, glyphosate in particular has become very controversial. It's been overused, and it's the critics say that it's causing people to put so much more on it. And glyphosate's now everywhere, and it was a spot where either the industry, the companies, the government didn't tap the brakes, and instead we've now got glyphosate, you know, all over and lots of different foods. And so the critics point to this as the reason that you should oppose genetic engineering, because it's been overused, and now there is this big problem that they're worried about. How do you deal with that? How do you address that criticism?
Yeah, so there's a couple things I can say about that. One is, every type of trait is different, and genetic engineering is a technology that can create traits and create these things in different crops. And so what I'd like to have is a conversation where it's not about, well, we must oppose GMOs because of one kind of trait that can and has been used by farmers, but instead have the conversation about, well, these traits, yes, let's definitely have these ones, and then these ones, like herbicide tolerance, because of the kinds of problems that can come along with it, treat them a little bit differently. There have been a lot of proposals about, well, how about we regulate those differently, and it could also be maybe the pesticide itself should be regulated differently. I've had a lot of conversations with some weed scientists who are suggesting that there's an overemphasis on using herbicides for weed control, because life always tries to evolve its way around such controls, and the use of herbicides has been going up, whether you're talking about GMOs or non-GMO crops. And so the goal should be, what would be the best way to use those herbicides effectively and when you need to, and not so much focus on trying to throw out the baby with the bathwater on this particular technology. And there are drawbacks to herbicides for weed control, and just like there are drawbacks to any approach if you use mechanical weeding, or even burn down with you know, like a propane burner. Each one of these approaches has a drawback to it.
Well, isn't it a problem then that the companies, though, that sell herbicides also are the companies that own the seed companies? Because is that kind of a building conflict of interest? Because if we only have, there used to be like a half dozen companies that had most of the seed and the herbicide, and now they're on their way to down to three. A Chinese company has now gotten the go-ahead to merge with a European company, and, you know, we're down to like three, maybe four companies in the whole world that have most of this technology and much of the seeds. How do we deal with that, what appears to be a pretty serious conflict of interest?
Well, the companies each have different approaches, and one of the things that I point to is that, like, you know, so a company like Monsanto, they tend to put all their traits together into one plant. Like, you know, they have their like smart stacks or whatever, where it's like corn that has all these different BTs and different herbicide treatments, and some of those, the farmers don't even want all those traits, and you get a little bit of yield drag from breeding so many different lines together to try to get just those traits together. But other companies like DuPont Pioneer, they've done things where they try to I forget what their slogan is for it, but basically the idea that you would have different varieties for different farmers with different combinations of traits. And my worry is that the companies, especially if they're doing this consolidating, which, you know, worries me in different ways apart from the technology, is that they'll put all of the things that they think are going to be important together, but it's not necessarily exactly what everybody wants. And I don't think there's anything sinister about that. That's just like, you know, when a company becomes ubiquitous and big, like, you know, you walk into a McDonald's, they have a particular menu. They try to come up with something that most people will agree with, but, you know, it's not going to have exactly what you want at all times. So that's the thing that worries me there.
Well, you know, I think it's good to get us to admit to worrying about some of these areas, because I think it's one thing to start off, as we did with this conversation, and say that there's a lot of promise using the technology. Even the critics, I think, say that. More and more people that say, well, I'm not against genetic engineering per se, but certain things worry me. And the fact that there could be only, you know, three or four companies in the whole world that have the lion's share of the technology and seed stock, that worries me. Not much an individual can do about that, I suppose. I mean, it's good to maybe get to the stage you can at least admit to the fact that, wait a minute, there are things that do concern us on both sides of this, but that doesn't mean that there's not a spot for technology. Does the company that's doing this have to do adequate testing to be sure there's no unintended consequences? Are we going to find out that, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, we have worries like people have about glyphosate currently of being overused as a result of this technology? So what assurances do consumers have that as these new technologies, as promising as they are, come on board, that they've really anticipated all the things that might go wrong and that there won't be these unintended consequences coming up?
They had to do detailed compositional analyses to show that the reduction in the, you know, sugars and this one amino acid was what they got and not some other unintended consequences. You can also get unintended consequences from breeding as well, but those aren't often tested for. We actually, Biology Fortified, we maintain a database of studies on composition and animal feeding studies with genetically engineered crops, and still composition remains the best tool that we have, because you can see what all the actual differences are, and you can understand what the all the nutrients and mineral levels are. And these are apart from those intended changes. And but of course, it doesn't mean we can just go, oh yeah, we'll never find anything. Each one of these has to be assessed on a case by case basis to make sure that that we're having the intended changes and not the ones that we don't want.
Well, transparency seems to be always a key concern.
Yeah.
And I wonder, have you ever considered trying to draw more attention to the regulatory agencies and the star power that exists within government? Because there's this image that in government, you don't make nearly as much money as a private industry. So some of the critics say that the regulators can do a revolving door and go to work for who they're regulating, and so that causes them to hold back and not be as tough as regulators because they hope to have future employment with the company that is dealing with the agency. Do you run into those kinds of questions, and have you thought about trying to address those head on, or maybe draw more attention to the to these regulatory bodies to reassure people on how competent they may be?
For the agencies that regulate genetically engineered crops, the USDA, EPA, and FDA, they work together on, I think they call it a coordinated framework. And I think there could be some improvements made. I've certainly heard that it'd be easier if there was a single agency that regulated this. But, you know, to your question about revolving door, I've heard that claim made, but then when I go and look into what are the specific claims about this, then I find that there are a lot of cases where people they're saying had a conflict of interest actually recuse themselves from decision-making processes. And, you know, one name that comes up is Michael Taylor, who at one point was working for the FDA, and then he actually then worked for Monsanto afterwards and left that and went back to work for the government. He then became like the food safety czar. And even Marion Nestle from Food Politics, the nutrition professor, she endorsed him as well and said that he acted very well when it came to these potential conflicts. And I think, you know, there is always the potential of this kind of stuff, but it's very hard to tell somebody who's, you know, worked for government and then they're no longer working for them that they can't even, you know, work in this area anymore, or that the government can't use the expertise of somebody who's worked in various industries. We just have to make sure that that the conflicts are managed well so that it's in the public's interest and not in their own private interest. And I worked as a postdoc for the USDA for a year on a cucumber genome project. And, you know, if we're so much as going to go and like speak somewhere, or somebody wants to invite us somewhere, we gotta report every little detail of it, and because we're working for the public.
Well, I mean that's a really good example, and I've known people over the years that are public servants that their highest motivation isn't just trying to maximize how much money they can make in their lifetime. They really do want to make a contribution and serve the public, and thank goodness there's a lot of those people left in government today. Now I want to just kind of wrap up by going to the way that you communicate and explain these things, because you've come up with some really clever approaches, and you've got somebody called Frankenfood. Could you explain Frankenfood?
Yeah, glad you asked. Yeah, so back when we started our blog, I got this idea from an evolutionary biology website. They had a stuffed panda called Professor Steve, and he showed up here and there in a blog post and in a photo with the scientist. And I thought, I could do that for plants. So when we started, I created a plushie, and I named him Frank N. Food. And to just make light of that term, Frankenfood, that people throw around about this topic. And then I started to get emails from people saying, hey, when are you going to be in my area? Because I want to get my photo taken with Frankenfood. And it started to become its own thing and popular in its own right. And it got to the point where we ended up doing a Kickstarter to raise money to actually manufacture some plushies. And you can actually get one with a donation on our site right now if you want to. But we felt like it made the topic more fun and approachable and gave us a way to tell a story. You know, people don't care about, I'm sad to say, people don't care about plants that much. You show a picture of plants with a chicken in it, you go, what's this picture of? They go, a chicken. And not all the plants that are covering the other 85% of the photo. And so it's very hard to get people to follow a story about plants. But Frank, he's got his own Twitter account and Facebook page. It gives us an opportunity to tell essentially like a story with a person with a personality, but it's a plant. And so we have some laughs every now and then, some plant-based puns. And I'm working on some cooking videos right now, one of which is out, called Cooking with Frankenfood, and to have him as a little character on camera with me. And just trying to make it approachable so people can talk about it. And we also have a papaya named Lana Kila on Awainaway Papaya. Our donors voted that the papaya should be the next plushie. And we're working on a couple other ideas in the near future of different plushies.
Well, plug that again. If somebody wants to get to your site, find out more of what you're up to, but also get Frankenfood or figure out how they can connect with the infographics and so forth you have available, where do they go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's biofortified.org. And under the Support Us tab is where you can find info about our plant plushies. And, yeah, we're actually even thinking about doing some scavenger hunt contests in the future where you could take your photo, take photos of Frank with something in the background. And you guys get to hear the first hints of this outreach project on your show. But it's might be later this year.
Well, Carl, thank you. I just in wrapping up, I want to kind of look ahead over this next 3 or 4 years. This whole debate and controversies and suspicion and mistrust and around GMOs just sometimes feels like it's never ending. What makes you feel that in fact might be different in the near future? What gives you some optimism as you look down the road 2, 3, or 4 years that we're going to be in a different position about an issue like this than we are today?
What I think gives me hope about the conversation is that when we started our blog in 2008, we were the only show in town, and Monsanto didn't even have their own blog yet. And now, today, I see a lot of new ones cropping up and a lot of different conversations. People have been a part of the conversation on our site, starting their own projects. And I'm diving into conversations where I'm going to say, hey, we made an infographic that helps explain this aspect. And then I find that somebody's already plugged the infographic. So there is a sustained conversation going on. And people who are in the vast majority who are the undecided middle are starting to learn and listen about this topic. And I think that's a really good thing, because it's been a lot of very polarized extremes, and people who are coming in the discussion now aren't taking on that same polarization that that I saw before we got involved.
Well, then I just have to ask one final question, because you have gotten involved, and there are people that are starting to scratch their head and say, well, maybe I was wrong, or maybe there is potential. However, this really is an issue. I mean, are you going to be able to play both sides in a way and draw attention to areas, we could do a better job, or we could as an industry, you know, address this more. We could, you know, not put all our eggs in the pesticide basket and promote more aggressively, you know, working on some of these other traits and getting them out there. So do you see a role to become more proactive about recognizing good recommendations and changes no matter which side they come from, versus having to split up and say, you know, it's like a basketball game where you're saying whose shirts and skins, you know, which side are you on? But recognizing, I think, some strong suggestions that come from people that were former or current critics?
Long question.
I know it's a terrible question. You should never ask a question like that when you're having a podcast. But
especially right at the end. But
I know. But, you know, it just seems to me, like, to your point, there's so much polarization. And part of polarization is just not having my side win and not listening to the other and condemning, but possibly being able to recognize, okay, that's a good point. Maybe this is something that we do need to pursue.
Yeah, and there have been some inklings of this, even some people who've been, you know, very stridently against all kinds of GMOs. Have even said, well, actually, there could be some good ones. The couple of revelations came up like that came up in the Food Evolution documentary. But I think one of the ways out of this is recognizing the difference between facts and values. And one of the things that I've been interested to do, and we started doing this with a citizen science experiment in the past year, without going too much detail into it, but basically to take a claim out there and let everybody get in on testing it together, to do the experiment in one, you know, with hundreds of people doing this experiment and then all putting their data together. And I'm interested to do more of these kinds of things. I'd really like to get some people who have concerns about GMOs to participate, help us come up with ideas that can be easily tested through science, and then we'll come up with conclusions that everybody can agree with and put it out there. And I'm one of the things I'm interested to do next is test some of the claims made by the biotech industry, by the organic industry, by people in the middle, and be able to do some experiments that test all of these claims in a very public way and allow us to all develop a model together for how all of this fits together and how this fits together in our lives. That's something that I'd really like to see more of. There's been too much tribalism and not enough of that, because scientific controversies aren't answered by people yelling at each other. They're answered by data and by agreement from multiple parties.
Well, I'm glad I asked that long question. That was a really good answer, and your answer was shorter than my question was. And I always like to congratulate those people that are investing in bridge building. And I think you are. You're venturing out into an area that you are going to have people shooting at you from both sides.
Oh, yeah. That's actually one of my goals, is to have a critic on both ends.
Well, I think you've succeeded so far. You're doing some good work, and you're asking tough questions, and you've got some interesting approaches. And I really appreciate Dr. Carl Harl von Mogel being on Farm to Table Talk this morning. Carl, thank you.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.